information with you will be of great benefit to this committee.
Honourable members, we are supposed to adopt the report on the ATT, but since other members are still committed somewhere, they'll join us later. I thought we should start with the presentation from the South African Defence Force Reserve, and then we will go back to the adoption of the report as other members come in. I'm Malusi Stendi Mutimele, the chairperson of this portfolio committee, the co-chairperson of the Joint Standing Committee on Defense.
Morning, everybody. I'm Dumisani Kamete, member of this committee.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Boris Lenesi, a member of the committee.
Good morning. My name is David Maney. I'm a member of the Portfolio Committee. Thank you.
Shahid Issa, member of the committee.
I'm Major General Roy Anderson. I'm Chief of Defence Reserve, and I'm a Reserve Force officer. So other than spending 4 days a week in uniform, I'm a chairman of the
Good morning, members. I'm Tobegile Kamete, acting Secretary for Defence.
Morning, honourable members. Major General Raman Tswana, Chief Military Policy, Strategy and Planning.
Morning, honourable members. I'm Brigadier General Debbie Molefe, Director, Defence Reserves. I'm a regular member, Chief of Staff of Major General Anderson.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Brigadier General Gerard Comfort, Director, Army Reserves.
Morning, everybody. I'm Brigadier General Abel Maminza. I'm Director, SAMS Reserves. I'm a reservist. Otherwise, outside of this, I'm a medical doctor.
Morning, everybody, gentlemen. I'm Admiral Junior Grade Ralph Ndabambi in the Fleet Fleet Command HQ in Somerset. Thank you.
Captain, South African Navy, Marcus Ramutla, SSO Defence Reserve, Western Cape. In my private life, I'm a marine pilot, Table Bay Harbor.
The way, Captain, when you say in your private life you are a marine pilot, what does that mean? When you are not a soldier, you are a marine pilot.
Marine pilot, yeah. I'm in the reserves as a reservist, but in my life, other job that I do, the other days when I'm not here, I'm a marine pilot. I work in the harbor, all those ships that you see coming in, so we bring them in and then we bring them out.
Like when General Anderson is a chairperson of companies, when he's not in uniform.
Yes.
Means the same thing?
Same thing.
Okay.
If not better.
General Anderson, over to you. We'll listen to your presentation.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just going to say that the questions about reserves that were raised yesterday will be answered today.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, members.
Can you press your mic?
Is that better?
No.
Is that better now?
No, press the mic. It's not pressed.
Yeah. Is that better? Thank you. Hang on.
This thing, can we just have the technician, because this computer of yours is not so lacquer.
There we go. It'll come back down. Switch that one off. Take off my computer. Okay. There we go. We'll get there. Right. Thank you, Chairperson. So the aim of today is to brief the Portfolio Committee on the status and revitalization of the reserves, and we will try and contextualize it within the defense review.
so that it, we can put it into some sort of form that you can then assess where we are. The first point I want to make is that I do not command the reserves. The reserves are commanded by the four service chiefs. So the chief of the army has his reserves. My job is a staff officer. I advise the chief of the defense force. I sit on the military command council and the plenary defense staff council. And now I'm on the defense review implementation team to implement the defense review. But the command does not rest with me or my colleagues. We are staff officers. The content, I thought what we'd do, Chairperson, is to first of all go into the background. Why do we have reserves? Why don't we just have a big regular army or navy or air force? What's the minister's priority? How do we interpret the one force concept? What is the role of the reserves? And here I draw heavily on the defense review. Why do we have reserves? And what are they going to do? And how does the system work? Then I'll show you where we are now. What are our strengths? And there I will contextualize the strengths against the milestones in the defense review. What is the equity status, both in gender and in race? Brief comments on the university reserve training program and a summary of what we've achieved. Then we get to the difficult bit, where do we want to be? What is the revitalization and transformation plan? And what are the challenges we're facing to get there? Feeder systems, continuation training, leader group development, and then I'll draw a conclusion. The first thing, Chairperson, is why do we have reserves? Why don't we just have a big regular army? The answer is briefly, reserves are good for citizenship. It's good for nation building. You involve the country in your defense force. So we popularize the defense force. Next, and this is most important, the reserves are the most cost-effective option, without doubt. We are not paid when we're not called up. When I leave here today and I go home, I'm off the payroll. If I get called up tomorrow, I'm back on the payroll. We do not get pensions, and we only get medical cover when we're in uniform. So to put it cynically, if I were to have a heart attack now, I'd go to the military hospital. If I have one tomorrow, I'll have to go to my civilian hospital. So it is definitely a cheaper option. But more constructively, the reserves provide access to scarce or expensive skills which the Defence Force can't retain. And here we talk about specialists in the form of medical specialists, as we would commonly accept. But we also talk about specialists in the area of cyber, lawyers, doctors, accountants. You'll see later that the Chief of the Army, for example, has a spool of specialists who are top business people or professionals, and he brings them in when he needs them. The reserves provide the surge capacity. So in other words, for economic reasons, we can only retain relatively small defense. So where do you get your surge capability for? Your big conventional capability for times of wars. You get them from your reserves. And of course having the reserves is a legal requirement required by the white paper, the defense review of 96, and now of course the defense review of 2014-15. So that's why we have reserves. Let me share with you the business case. Reserves are a lot less expensive than regulars. Let me give you a statistic. The reserves currently only take 7% of the Army salary budget. 7%. 0.7. Yet the reserves are providing more than 50% of the deployments. Let me re-emphasize that. The reserves are providing more than 50% of the deployments, or 7% of the budget. That figure is a little bit of a cheat, because the 7% is the Army's budget for force preparation. It does not include the budget for joint operations to actually deploy the reserves. So it is a little bit of a cheat, so let me declare that. But the bottom line is the reserves are the cheapest option. You'll see later that on border safeguarding, the reserves over the past year have on average provided 65% of the deployments. 65% for 7% of the budget. I'm talking Army there. And of course, for peace support operations, typically the reserves in the infantry are providing 25% of the deployments. So it's a very cost-effective option. Putting it in the context of the defense review, as you know, the defense review says that 8% of personal expenses should be ring-fenced for reserves in the target budget. This is what the minister's priority is. It's her priority number 6, and obviously we're driving to get there. The language has been a little bit superseded by the defense review, but the sentiment is right.
As part of the One Force concept, the reserves will continue to be transformed and revitalized to fulfill their primary role of providing a large component of the conventional landward capability of the SANDF, whilst at the same time supplementing peace support missions conducted by the regulars. So the Minister is right behind the concept of transformation and revitalization of the reserves. And let me say, the Chief of the Defence Force's priorities echo the same sentiment. Let me just pause for a moment, Chairperson, on the concept of the One Force. As you know, the Defence Force consists of three components: the regulars, the reserves, and the civilians, all equally important. But the point that I want to stress, that when it comes to regulars and reserves, the training is equal. The standard is equal. I did the same staff course to become a general as my regular force counterpart. When we deploy reserves, their training pre-deployment is at the same standard as the regulars. They get evaluated at the same time. So the reserves are not a second-class standard. But the service conditions vary, obviously, because we're not there full-time. An important point to note is that the reserves are not employees and therefore are not unionized. So there is no union in the reserve force. What is the role of the reserves? And this is per the Defence Review, which is before you at the moment. The first role is to augment the regulars in ongoing operations and day-to-day activities of the Defence Force. Second one is to form part of the standing and surge military capability. Now, if you take the Chief of the Defence Force's reserve, not the reserve force, reserve, either immediate ready reserves, there's only one reserve unit in that, and that's 3 parachute battalion. But the reserves really form the core of the surge capability, the core of the conventional force. Be it artillery, be it armor, be it air defense artillery is sitting in the reserves. So we provide the expansion capability for major combat operations and crisis response. As I indicated earlier, we provide certain specialists and scarce skills to the Defense Force. We provide the main specialist capability for reconstruction and development. Reconstruction and development lies in the reserves. And, of course, we enhance the relationship between the Defense Force, the public, and the private. Let me say that I focused, probably unfairly, on the Army in these comments, in my example, but it applies equally to the 3 other services. Now, the reserves are employed at all levels of the Defence Force, in every command body we represent. I'm there every Monday at the Military Command Council, Defence Staff Council, most Thursdays at the Defence Review Implementation Team. And similarly, my colleagues, General Comfort, the first one I see, sits in on the Army Command Council. He's a full member. So we are represented, some people say we've infiltrated, but we're at all levels of the Defence Force. How do you become a member of the reserves? Well, first of all, we took our members from the former forces, be it statutory or non-statutory. That source is reducing because, with due respect to all of us, including me, we're getting a bit older now. So there isn't a big source of former MK UPLA or SADF or TVDC. The second one is a very welcome shift, where regulars who leave the regular force are joining the reserves. We even got battalion commanders in the infantry who form a regular. We've got the good captain at the end who explained to you that he's a pilot in the harbour. Well, he was a regular, left the regular force, and has now come back as our SSO reserves in Cape Town. In theory, Chairperson, we get our main intake from the military skills development. The reality is that the intake into the MSDS is less than the attrition in the regular. Therefore, there is no flow from MSDS, particularly in the Army, into the reserves. In the other 3 services, and maybe under question time we could explore that, there is a small flow from MSDS. But in the Army, MSDS now doesn't even replace the attrition rate in the regular. Direct recruitment. Historically, we recruited directly. Once again, forgive the Army example. But into the battalions, they were trained on a decentralized basis and then evaluated centrally by the School of Infantry to make sure the standard of the training was there. Then I've mentioned the pool of specialists, where the Chief of the Army particularly has a pool of highly qualified people, and then into the University Reserve Training Program, we'll be taking university students and training them to be officers in the reserves, and I'll expand on that just now. This is the classic model, Chairperson, but at the moment it is not working because of the small MSDS intake. But typically the model is go onto high school campuses, try and get into the rural areas if you can, recruit the people at battalion or unit level. Then the selection is done centrally. It is now done by the four services from next year, not by HR. And the same psychometric tests and evaluations apply throughout so that the standard is there. The young men and women come in for 2 years. We hope in the Army,
they will have had one deployment, either in Sudan or in the Congo or maybe on the borders. So they come out seasoned soldiers. Then we try and provide a limited amount of reskilling at the end of their 2 years. The budget is pretty limited, and you can imagine with a small budget you don't get a lot of reskilling. But where we have put emphasis is to try and find these MSDS members that are not going into the regular force but joining the reserve force, civilian jobs. The average success rate is we found about 65% of them jobs in civilian life, which we feel a moral obligation to do because they've had 2 years of income, they've supported the families, and now they lose that income because they haven't joined the regular force. So we help with job placement. The Navy's been very good in finding jobs in the harbors, etc., and the Army has links with certain employers such as Transnet, the urban railways, etc. Some of the MSDS members have joined correctional services and SAPs, in which case they are lost to the Army because you can't wear two uniforms in terms of the Defense Act. We then sign them up for a 5-year contract in the reserves, and we find the vast majority sign up for another 5 years and another 5 years. So the model is 2 years MSDS, civilian job, 5 years in the reserves. And we'll show you a statistic just now, well I will, as to how many of them are still there through the MSDS system, still in the reserves. And we hope in the 5 years they'll have at least one deployment, maybe two, maybe three. Let's pause a little bit. I'll go a bit slower on this slide, Chairperson. This is our current strength of the reserves. So we started with the Army. There are 14,154 reserves in the Army. Now, that's a fresh list. They are not old and bold and been there. These are people that have been called up in the last 2 years. So they exist. So if the Chief of the Army pushed the button, he could produce 14,154. If you see, the Air Force is small, the Navy is fairly small, Military Health Service, as one would expect, a bit bigger, Joint Operations, there's quite a lot of reserves, and then the others are people in headquarters, etc., intelligence. In total, however, right now, we have 22,077 reserves on the books who exist and can be contacted. Now, of that 22,000, in the year to March, we actually called up 14,866, and that you've seen in the annual report. I think that's the figure. I'm talking from memory, but I'm pretty sure that's right. So of the 22,000, 14,866 did service last year. In the 6 months to September this year, you can see I've given you the latest figure, 13,460 have already done service in the 6 months. Of course, you can't multiply that by two and say we're going to call up 26,000. That would be nonsensical when we've only got 22,000. The people who get called up in the second half are often the same people who were called up in the first half. But if I say to you that last year we called up 14,866, the point to be made is numerically we meet milestone one of the defense review. The defense review says in milestone one you must have 15,000 active reserves. In milestone one, it talks about active, not total. And we are on milestone one numerically. We're there already. Milestone two requires us to get to 25,000, and the ultimate goal for the defense review is to get to 82,000. And later in the presentation, we'll share with you the opportunities and the challenges. Let's look at the equity status. being South Africa, it's important to monitor this. The reserves are now, let's say, 71% black. When I say black, I mean African black. Of course, in 1994, they were 100% white because we were all conscripts. Asian, less than a percent. Coloured, about 13% in round terms. White's now down to about 16%, which is lower than the demographics would require. So the total reserves, 22,000 are there. The female component is 23.5%. We hope to get to 30%, but what's holding us back there is there's no MSDS intake into the reserves at the moment. So you don't get the female intake. The average age, a little bit of concern, is 38. I would stress, however, that 38 is the average age of the 22,000. The age of the 15,000 that we called up tends to be younger, but it is still too old. To have an infantier of 38 is too old to, with respect to all of us, well, presumably most of us are over the age of 38. You want an infantier to be no more than 26 or 27. But once again, you can see this implication of the lack of funds for a feeder system. This is a very busy slide, so I apologize, but I'll extract the thing. What tends to happen is if you look at the demographics in total, we're doing very well. But if you look at by rank group, you can see from the rank of captain upwards and the rank of staff sergeant upwards, it's still more whites than blacks. What that is saying is the transformation is not coming through the system to the senior ranks. Why is that? Once again, a lack of funds for the promotional courses and the experience required to get promotions. So if you look under African percentage, so I'm now in the third row, you can see the majors, the lieutenant generals are 100% black. Those are former regulars that are kept in the reserves for inquiries, etc. If you move across, you can see that the colonel to major level is only 21% black. But at captain to second lieutenant level is 53% black. So you can see the potential is there. It's the funds that are required for those final training courses and the experience required to get promotions. And you'll see a similar trend in the NCOs. So in total, the transformation is working, but it's not going right through the system as fast as we would like. Let me talk to you briefly about the University Reserve Training Program. It's been proved throughout the world that a very good source of leaders for the reserve force is your universities. So what we've done is we've gone onto campus. Thank you. We've gone onto campus and we've recruited the best brains we can find in order to train them as the future leaders in the reserves. And I'll show you this on this slide how far we've got. Sorry for the abbreviations, but if you look there, you can see where it says BMT, that's basic military training. So in the Free State, the Army has put 58 through basic military training. In the Western Cape, that's the figure for the Army and for SAMS. The Air Force, the Navy, the Air Force was in Gauteng at Wits and Tuckies, and so we go on. Officers' formative training is the initial training you get in order to become an officer. So you can see we've got to officers' formative training. If you add that all up, we're about 350 university students have done officers' formative training. But to show you the enthusiasm, when we went onto campus in early this year in KZN in Natal, we had 1,610 applicants for 200 slots in this program. So we had 8 times more people than we could absorb. I did see a parliamentary question, which crossed my desk, which said, if there's a lack of interest in the reserves, can we meet the defense review requirements? I just want to clarify. There is no lack of interest in the reserves. The lack is our ability to train them and use them. The youth of today want to serve in the reserves. We are a very fortunate country. The demand for reserve force involvement is greater than what we can meet as the defense force. And there are not many countries that can say that. So I think it speaks well of our youth. So that's the University Reserve Training Program. Now, what we're doing now is we're pausing, because once an officer has done officers formative, There's another thing that needs to be done, and that's what we call functional training. So up to there, you've done basic military training, and you've been rounded as an officer. But before we can deploy you, you have to do what we call functional training. So if in the armor, you have to go to the school of armor to learn to command a troop of tanks or armored cars. Or you have to go to the infantry school to learn to be a platoon commander. So this year, we're focusing on pushing all those through the final step, because at the end of the day, we need leaders that we can actually deploy and use. Obviously, I'm not objective here, but I can assure you, first of all, that group meets the demographics of South Africa without any problems. They just naturally come out in the right mix. But second of all, they are extremely impressive. They get through basic training in 50% of the time of an MSDS member, because they're all second, third year, fourth year students. Some of them have even got master's degrees already. So it is a great system. We've just got to make sure that they become deployable at the end. I'm going to run through, Jefferson, very quickly some of our other achievements, and then we'll get on where we want to be. So the first big achievement is we have changed the demographics. Not quickly enough at the senior ranks, but in total the demographics are coming right. I indicated before the deployments of the reserves are very, very high. In peace support operations, to date, we've deployed over 45 companies. I think we're probably close to 40 companies, and there are, let's take a company with 140 members. On border safeguarding, including the Kruger National Park, we've deployed 52 companies. Just as an aside, if I may go back to the peace support operations, what's not commonly known, the four troops who were injured in Sudan 3 weeks ago are reservists. They're with four, with a regular battalion, four SAI, but they are company from a reserve unit called the South African Irish. What we do for peace support operations, because the United Nations wants three rifle companies in a battalion, the fourth company is typically a reserve company which is attached to a regular battalion. I trust that makes sense. And those four youngsters who were injured in Sudan 3 weeks ago are reservists. The good news is every report indicates they put up a hell of a fight. One is back in Pretoria, and the other severely injured one, I believe, is still in the Sudan. We've done a lot of internal operations. We've used the reserves for the World Cup, xenophobia, the public service strike. Remember, the reservists manned the hospitals. We've used reserves at Home Affairs when they were changing their model. And we used the reserves to register the military veterans. We moved them, sent them into the rural areas to find the old military veterans to register them. We've created defense provincial liaison councils in eight provinces. That's a body between the captains of industry, academia, NGOs, tribal traditional leaders, and politicians. And there are committees in the areas to support reserve service. I'm going to talk briefly. The air reserve squadrons are grounded at the moment. Now, the air reserve squadrons are 200 pilots who come with their own civilian aircraft. So when the chief of the Air Force calls up a reserve squadron pilot, he or she arrives with aircraft. They're grounded at the moment because the Auditor General has a query as to whether this is leasing through the back door. The sums indicate clearly that it's the cheaper option. In other words, the reserve aircraft comes far cheaper than an arm's length lease, but understandably there are issues that are being resolved between the Auditor General and the Air Force. The Navy reserves, and I'm glad that the Admiral is here, but the Navy has had a serious endeavor, and they're putting together a new plan to revitalize the reserves. And similarly, the SAMs are putting together their own revitalization plan. Just for a change of pace, I just thought I'd show you that picture. That's a reserve section on patrol in northeastern Congo, just north of Goma. Last time I was up there, it was midnight, it was raining, and it was 40 degrees. So you can see that deployment terrain is not for sissies. And there's another picture. That's a reserve battalion from Grahamstown called First City. And there they are busy receiving their United Nations medal after their deployment. The external deployments, of course, are interesting for reserves now because they are 12-month deployments. That's a long time for a reservist, but at this stage we're getting no pushback. We're getting the numbers we need. What else have we achieved? We've integrated the ex-combatants. We do have regulations of the Defence Act for the reserves, and indeed we're updating them at the moment. There is another body called the Reserve Force Council, which is retired Reserve Force members who have a role in terms of the Defence Act, and we work closely with them, and we have an MOU between us. The Defence Act, as you know, Parliament saw fit to change the Defence Act 2 years ago, I think it was, to change the conditions under which you call up a reserve. The old Act said you may only call a Reserve Force member up in times of war. Parliament saw fit to agree with us. It now says you may call a Reserve Force member up in times of need. So the effect is, if you sign the five-year contract and you get called up by the Commander-in-Chief, you will arrive, otherwise you'll be prosecuted. So it's a guaranteed force. You will see that following from the defense review, included in the request to Parliament, we have certain requests with regard to the Reserve Force, particularly, and I'll just give you a taste of what may come before you, we want further protection for reservists against discrimination by their civilian employers. There's only one line in our Defence Act at the moment. We've looked at models such as the Australian and the Canadian models, and we think we need to beef that up, but that'll come before the committee in the fullness of time with all the Defence Review legislation. Last two items on the slide, Chairperson, just a quick brag. Last year we sent our Reserve Force shooting team to Holland to compete in the European Championships against NATO. The South African Defence Force Reserve Force shooting team won the competition. We beat all the NATO countries. This year we sent our military skills team to compete once again against the NATO countries in Germany. That is rifle shooting, pistol shooting, cross-country, water obstacle, land obstacle, hand grenade throwing, distance estimation. We won. Our Reserve Force team beat 22 teams from NATO and came back with the first position and the gold medals. What am I saying in my brag, my unashamed brag? Our reservists can shoot and their skills are high. Other achievements, we provide a lot of support to the community, such as bridge building. We support the youth. The Army has the Young Lions, the Air Force, CNDESA. The Navy has Sea Cadets, and of course we support the National Youth System. The reserves are addressed and supported extensively in the Defence Review. I did a word search. There's 64 references to the reserves in the Defence Review. Possibly not surprising because General Gibbs, who I'm sure you've met, is a reservist and he reports to me. So we kept in close touch to make sure that the reserves were in fact appropriately addressed. Quick diversion, the educational trust set up by General Shawkey to look after the children of our deceased and severely injured, which was set up after the Battle of Bangui. I'm the chairperson of that. I set up the trust. It's run out of the Defence Reserves Office. Last year we educated 39 children. Last week we've already approved 49 bursaries for next year, and 7 of the recipients are children of reservists. Just a change of pace. Those are the colours with their battle honours of some of the Reserve Force battalions that have been deployed externally on parade in Bloemfontein. I'm sure many members of the committee or some of you were there at that parade. Right. So now where do we want to take the reserves and how are we going to get there and what are the limitations? Even before the defence review, in September 2011, with General Molefe, my chief of staff, and with the service chiefs, we prepared a full plan to transform and revitalize the reserves. And the plan, as you'll see just now, contains 17 elements. The plan was accepted in full by the Military Command Council, but of course when the chief of the Defence Force appended his signature, he did say approved, subject to the availability of funds, which we all understand is a challenge for the country and the Defence Force. I won't go through each of these headings, Chairperson, but the plan addresses the force design, the structure, the types, the role, the size, the leader group development, the footprint of the reserves, the balance between units in rural areas and urban areas, the Army name changes of the units, which I'll touch on another slide, training of the reserves, legislation, service benefits, utilisation of reserves and management. Now, we've tested that plan against the Defence Review, and surprisingly, it fits in very, very well. There is no misalignment. Let me highlight some of the key challenges we face. At the moment, many of the Reserve Force members are unemployed in their civilian life. The privates typically do not have a civilian job. Now, the good news is, therefore, when we call them up, they all arrive. The bad news is you wonder if their motivation is to be a soldier or to make a living. So what we're trying to do in our process is to make sure that we only recruit into the reserves genuine, let me call them warriors, people who want to be soldiers, sailors, airmen. But now we've got to assume that the reserves won't always be unemployed in their civilian jobs. So that means the system must appeal to the youth of today, but must accommodate the employers of reserves, the civilian employers. So what are we focusing on in the plan? Skills development. Making sure that the reservist has a way of making a civilian living after MSDS. Pushing the job placement to find jobs. Now we have some good relationships such as with PRASA, Transnet, Imperial Logistics, etc., where they give our people jobs. In fact, they seek reservists because of their discipline. We're looking at incentives for the reserves. And after benchmarking, particularly with the New York National Guard, it seems like the best incentive you can give a reservist is educational reserve. In other words, bursaries and scholarships, because that's what they seek, and that will make them available for civilian employment. Will we ever get to employer incentives? Challenging. The Australians went the route of full incentivization. It nearly bankrupted them. The British say we will only pay an employer during an extensive call-up. So presumably that's a deployment, in their case, to Iraq or Afghanistan. But they won't incentivize an employer for a normal call-up. But in the plan, we address all the challenges, and the solutions were approved. I touched on earlier on that as we sit here now, we don't have a feeder system for the reserves. There is no system to bring in new recruits because the MSDS intake has been cut to less than the attrition rate of the regulars. I stress that's an Army example. We are having a small flow in the Air Force, Navy, and SAPS. Now, the consequences of not having an intake into the reserves is the question is how long we'll be able to maintain this high deployment rate. If the reserves are providing such high deployments, deployability, where do we get the new ones from? The second one is you saw the average age of a reservist is now 38. And, of course, we saw on the one slide that the leader group is not transforming quickly enough. There's still too much of a bias towards white leader group at the senior levels. I put at the bottom the figure required to overcome this problem. It is not enormous. The figure might have needs to be updated for inflation since then. But we're not talking billions to overcome this problem. We're talking hundreds of millions. The next thing is that our training for the reservists, and once again, forgive the Army example, is heavily towards pre-deployment training. And I just want to emphasize, we do not deploy a reserve company or battalion unless it is fully up to standard. It has the same standards as the regular force. But it means that a lot of the money is going into pre-deployment training. And therefore, normal conventional training for units that are not deploying, often from the artillery or the armor, just isn't there. And the fact that we're not doing enough continuation training means that some of the black youngsters can't get promotion because they've done the theoretical course, but there isn't a practical opportunity to get the practical done to get their promotion. We don't necessarily have enough funds for leader group development, and that's the other challenge. I'll say a few lines on the Army name changes, but General Comfer, who's driving the process on behalf of General Masondo, is here. Basically, the names of the Reserve Force Army units fall into three broad categories. I'm simplifying. Those that come from the British past, those that come from the Afrikaans Boer past, and those that are neutral or have numbers. Now, we're saying, that's fine. But surely the regiments must recognize the non-statutory force history and the realities of today. So what we want, and we've asked the regiments on a voluntary basis, to come forward with new names which will enrich and that they're not only drawn from the one segment of the population. The response has been quite positive. There is a will to change the names, and we will, I'm very confident, land up with a right balance between an English name, a name from the Boer past or the Afrikaans past, a name from MK and Opla, and names from the future. But what's the acid test? We want to come up with names that appeal to the youth of today. It's not what we, the old boys, think. We've had our day. The youngsters must find the names that these regiments have relevant and appealing to them. But if you have questions, General Comfort is here, and he's driving the process for General Masondo. After General Masondo, of course, it has to go to the Military Command Council, and ultimately the minister has to authorize name changes. Okay, I'm getting near the end, Chairperson, because I'm sure the questions are the important ones. So where do we go to from here? We're going to implement the defense review, supplemented by General Shockley's commander's intent. As part of the DRIPT defense review implementation team, we are analyzing how we're going to take this reserve force to where it needs to be. The first challenge, of course, is to arrest the decline. And that is challenging if you don't have a new intake and if you don't have money for continuation training. We're going to finalize the force design, and perhaps I could just pause for a bit, and once again, Chairperson, under questions this might come out. We're trying to understand, because we didn't write the defense review, it was written by a very talented team, how did they get to the number of reservists at the end of the defense review? Now, simply put, take the army. They said this is the ambition of the defense review. We need the three divisions. Right? Now, we want to spend only 40% of the budget on HR. And 8% of that should be for the reserves. And from that formula, they landed up with a relationship between regulars and reserves. They did do a model for a full regular force army, and of course it just blew the budget right out of the water. It's twice as expensive. So the size, the number of reserves, comes from an extrapolation from the ambition at the end. It was reverse engineered. I didn't do it. I wasn't party of it. But we obviously have asked the question, how did you get to the 85,000? Where did it come from? And once again, the services are here today to answer the question, if you have service-specific questions as to how did you get to that number. How did they get to the 15,000? Now, that 15,000 was based on a conservative view as to what is required. It is probably too low in the sense that we're not meeting all the Operation Corona commitments. We could deploy more companies if we had more. But we are meeting milestone one, as I said, and I've explained to you where the final milestone comes from or the ultimate outcome. What else are we going to do? We're focusing on transformation heavily. We're looking at a new reserve military skills development system for reserves only, and there was a meeting chaired by General De Witt last week where we're trying to look at a process of bringing the reserves in separately, not part of the normal MSDS, and finding them jobs at the end and having separate intakes. We're looking at direct recruitment again, where the battalions will recruit and retrain directly, and we will continue to support the National Youth Service, the Young Lions, C&Ds, and the Sea Cadets. The last one is, if you like, forgive me, as a note to myself. I've been on a program of just sitting down with the chiefs of the services and saying, sir, can we just talk reserves? I'm here to support you just like your director of reserves is. What can we do to help you to get where we mutually want to be? Forgive the word mandate budget. It's now been changed to person day budget. It was changed in the APP for this year. It's now person day. It's not mandate. The budget was cut right down to $1,870,000 in the in-year. I'm pleased to tell you that on Monday we were shown a new figure by Dr. Gamedi and her staff. It's now back up to $2.4 million man days for the budget. So we've made progress there. We've got to look at the reserve's potential to support the government's developmental agenda. We're extending our role on rural development. And once again, General Comfort is here. He is driving the rural development plan for the reserve, so feel free to ask him questions. We want to roll the University Reserve Training Program out to all provinces. We will be coming to request you to consider new legislation, but it will come, I understand, in one package for all the defense review implementations. And we have just signed off at my level on an update of all the regulations for reserves covering their terms, their conditions, their call-up duties, a revised contract, and that's going to the Human Resources Board next week. But all of this is once again, and I'm sure you hear that from everybody who sits before you, it's all dependent on budget. So what's the conclusion? Chairperson, I think we can say I am really proud of the reserve's role in the deployments. We have made, and I can say this in all humility, we have made a serious, serious contribution to the deployments of the Defence Force. And I'm proud of what we've done with this new University Reserve Training Program. I wish you could see the caliber of the students. And by the way, we're hoping about 10 to 15% of these students will join the regular force. There is commitment to the reserves in the SANDF, and I should go beyond that. From the minister down, there's strong commitment to the reserves. And strong commitment to the reserves in the defense review. Where are we focusing now? We've got to find a better feeder system. We've got to rejuvenate. The age is too high. We need more time on continuation training, more time on leader group development, which will lead itself to transformation. But all is subject to funds. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, General Anderson. I see it seems there is a strong commitment to the reserves from all levels except us here in the committee. So we must assure you that we'll support the reserves too. And before I give honorable members an opportunity to interact with your presentation, can I just find out what are the status of recruitment in terms of MSDs as acting SecDef?
The status?
Yeah. Have you stopped? Is it continuing? What is that?
We will have an intake next year. The problem, though, is that because of the budget, National Treasurer insists that we cut the intake. So we will not have an intake. We will have a reduced intake.
All right. They will note it. I think honorable members will also note it. Honorable Minister? Honorable Nisi, you'll follow.
Thank you, Chair, and let me thank General Anderson for the presentation, and I certainly share his excitement with many aspects of the presentation, especially the University Reserve Training Program, which I think is a great innovation and is showing great progress. I've got a couple of questions. The first concerns the Defence Review in 1998. Now, we are sitting in a situation where there's excessive expenditure on personnel. The defense budget is now consuming, I think personnel is consuming more than 54% of the defense budget. The reason for that, in my view, is that the concept set out in the Defense Review 1998, which provided for a small regular force and a large reserve force, was never implemented. If we go back to the Defence Force's own policy, the option recommended was for, I think, 70,000 reserves, and we have 20,000 reserves. My question to you is, why was the Defence Force's policy set out in the 1998 Defence Review never implemented? That is the origin, in my view, of much of the problem which the Defence Force currently sits with. That's the first question. The second question is the Defence Review 2014. Now, we were briefed yesterday that the implications of the Defence Review, of implementing Defence Review 2014, would be that the Defence Force would be downsized in the first 4 years, which is milestone one, by 27,958 personnel. That would include a downsizing of 7,113 reserve force personnel. It appeared to me, General, on your version, that you disagree, A, with the number, and B, that the
implications of the defense review would be that there would be an actual downsizing. In other words, that you would have to remove, as it were, 7,113 reserves from your establishment. It appears that you disagree with that. Is that correct? Thirdly, the MSDS system. I think you've been very clear that the MSDS system is not an effective feeder mechanism for the reserves. I wonder if you would share with us your ideas on the alternative options available to feed the reserves, which are presumably set out in the defense review. Then fourthly, you make a strong point that the deployment of a reserve member is more cost effective. I wonder if you could, if you've quantified the difference, for example, between deploying a regular soldier for a year compared to deploying a reserve soldier for a year, assuming that that reserve soldier receives, for example, one rotation during the year. I wonder if you've quantified that. I would be quite interested in the figure. Then I wonder if we look at side 12, whether the reserve forces deploy with the special forces. I'm currently looking into the whole question of the constitutionality of the deployment of special forces, which concerns me greatly. I'm investigating that currently. But I wondered if the reserve force members serve in the special forces and deploy with the special forces. And then finally, just a comment, not a question. I was responsible for the original complaint to the Auditor General, which had the unintended effect of shutting down the entire Air Force Reserve Squadron. Now, the questions that was raised in the first instance, I think 2 years ago, I think were valid. I hope that the situation is going to be resolved. But I would just like to draw to your attention, General, that there are, if we revert to the original system, there are significant risks. Because at the time, there were questions about, A, how decisions were being made in respect of the use of aircraft, and whether those aircraft were in fact owned by the pilots that came with the aircraft. I think that there were significant risks, and I just hope that you would keep an eye and ensure that those risks are mitigated going forward.
Honorable Munisi, you follow? And Honorable Skosan, you'll follow.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thanks for the presentation. Chair, my first question is based on the rank grouping of the reserve force. I've got a serious problem there regarding the number of males compared to the number of females. I'm worried, Chair, because 20 years in our democracy, but we still don't have females who are participating in higher ranks. We normally complain about this in other departments, but here in the defense force it's even worse. Chair, I think defense has a great responsibility to mold women into informed, competent, and cohesive military professionals so that we can be able to move our country forward. And here the numbers comparing the male, female, and the African, you can't compare a 52% to 18%. That is uncomparable. Moving down to 7% to 1%. Under 1%, 0.1 under females. It's really uncomparable, Chair. Then going to page 16, under the Universal Reserve Training Program Progress. There, it's only numbers. We are not sure how many females and how many males are there. I think that one is a great innovation, Chair. But we'd like to know exact numbers of females and males so that we can be able to look into the future. Then my question, Chair, what might be the problem or what might be the cause of this? And is there any plan in place moving forward to rectify this challenge or this problem? Then my second question, Chair, is a clarity-seeking question on page 13 of the presentation. I'm sorry. Okay. Here is it. On page 13, under the current equity status, there is number one, African, Asian, colored, white, and number five is unknown. So maybe if I can be clarified, Chair, about this 19 males which are unknown. I only need clarity on that one. Thank you so much.
Honorable Skosana, over to you.
Well, thanks, Chair. Chair, I'm partly covered by my colleagues on their input, particularly Honorable Mnisi. But Chair, on the same score in regarding with the rank groupings, really, Chair, something needs to be done here so that we can address these imbalances, because there is a lot of imbalances on this page. And when you look to the ranks, Africans, whites, and so on, really, it doesn't show any hope of an equality. Because we need to address this matter, because the disadvantaged must at least showing in the statistics that is coming up. And they must lead, Chair, not just to come on the numbers, but they must lead the system. That's what we want to see, because if we are prepared to take South Africa forward, must also even indicate at the workplace the leadership. If there is a skills shortage, that skills must be provided to those who should be, in fact, bringing up and make sure that we balance the equations here, Chair. But all in all, Chair, we understood the challenges, and I'm happy because even in the presentation, they are saying these challenges, they've got the plan of how to address them. But the problem is resources, the funding, how to fund their plans and so on, of which it should be a task and a challenge for all of us, including the politicians and the administration. But the plan is there. That plan, if it can be properly implemented, maybe it can assist us in other instances regarding the issues that have been raised here. Thanks, Chair.
Honorable Whip.
Thanks, Chair. I wish to firstly thank the presentation, and most of the issues have been covered. But as a principle, I think even the President said in 1 year that the budget must cover the backlogs. Are we doing that when we do our budget, even with regards to the reserves? If there is a huge backlog somewhere that would need to cover, For instance, let me take the issue of the recruitment at campuses. Your traditional universities are not there, you know. University of Zululand, Fort Hare, Venda, Limpopo, what do you call Limpopo? Now, how are you going to address this? You want to assist communities in rural areas, whereas the poorest of the poor go to those universities because they cannot go to University of Pretoria and VETS. And how are we going to address then these imbalances? You'll find that you'll try, but it will still go, you know, skewed. I think we need to solve the problem where it is. The mere fact that there is a drop of historically black students in these white universities doesn't mean that we are addressing the issue of the imbalances. So we'd want to see a deliberate, you know, attempt to attend to that. Second issue, which you also raised in the budget, is the lack of transformation in the South African Air Force. I see even in your presentation, you know, these years there's no recruitment. So we cannot identify a problem. And we keep on, I think, for a number of years, I can't remember the slides, but maybe it's from 2012, 2013, 2014, maybe even 2015, there is no will to recruit HDIs to be trained as pilots or whatever, as reserves, just for that purpose. So how are we going to achieve what we want to achieve as government if in your plans it's just not there? On the reserves, it's just not there. The issue of if one could get some meat on the rural development programs, I know the bridges. You know, that could make a very huge impact in the rural provinces of Eastern Cape, KwaZulu-Natal, Limpopo, if we can just focus on that. You know, I might not be shocked to find out that where you're building bridges, it's also maybe in peri-urban areas or even in urban areas. So to be specific, just put some meat and say in that area, because we would want to give you some areas. The chairperson would ask the chairperson, let's give the department some areas which we know really need these bridges. Thanks, Chair, for now.
Oh, thank you, Chair. See, I'm worried that the whip spoke before me, because all the questions that I had are the ones that he raised, because I was thinking about why. In fact, I need not to go back to that. I mean, I think it's going to be answered. But I'm trying to balance something here. We are talking about recruitment. On one hand, there's something about cutting budgets. Now, I can't see if there's something that is talking about cutting on budgets and this recruitment. How are these things going to happen? And then I understand this thing of regular and reserves and the reserves. Now, I want to check. You are saying you want to have a big reserve force which is cost effective, and then you have this minute or small regular force. Now, my interest is that if you are talking about that, I would love to have, maybe you said you are drawing the reserve force from those people which were coming from the other armies, apply and whatever. But my understanding is that there are many of them in these communities which are not part of the reserves. Are you focusing on recruiting them, getting them back to the army so that they can be part of the reserves, particularly in those rural areas, as that the whip was saying? That's something that I want to know. I understand you are getting to universities, but I've heard the other part, and I heard the last part saying you are going to go to other areas that you have not been there. But my interest now, here are these people which can be part of these reserves, which were coming from APLA, MK, and other forces. How? What is your plan in recruiting and getting them back? Because most of the time you've heard when people are talking about camps in transit and all these things, most of the time it will be referred to them that they are the most trained and whatever, and they might be doing their things. So as part of eliminating, including crime and other stuff, what is your plan to assist us? Thank you very much.
Honorable Issao.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I think I just want to raise the issue. Clearly, it's understandable when one speaks about the first milestone being 15,000, although we have a reserve force which is about 22,000. And you call them up as you need them, which means the 15,000 falls between the 22,000. If it gets 25,000 at the second milestone, the reserve should have increased to about 30,000 so that you can accommodate the need within the defense to be deployed. So from that perspective, I don't have a problem going ahead. It means there will be an increase in reserves. And, of course, when we look at the regulars, it's quite different. And we had an explanation yesterday for various reasons. The 66,000 regular force, that is excluding PSAP, will be dropped down to 47,000. And that is to revitalize it in different ways. Okay, the MEMS and all other things should be considered. One can understand, once you reorganize that, you see it jumps back to 64,000. So there will be a huge drive for recruitment, which means the MSDS and all other URTP and all other systems. And then, of course, we listen to the former Minister Sisulu. We also listen to Minister Nsimandi, Blades Nsimandi, speaking about the need to also use the Defense Force for NYS and to get more youth into those structures so that they also learn certain skills, one, whether it's with the FEA, what we call TVET colleges there these days, not FET, and also using the CETA system. So there's funding that will be flowing also from education into that. And I think this needs to be explored by the reserves. Funds that are available through other avenues. Secondly, the CAT has not been discussed at length and the use of the CAT, the Center for Advanced Training, in this respect. I think what we want to hear is there's a 720 million rand that needs to be cut from this budget, almost 1 billion that needs to be cut. Now, when we can cut, it means that we can't fulfill other commitments. But my contention simply is that we need to balance matters. If there's an excess in one, we need to cut back on that, and we need to increase it in other areas. It doesn't mean an increase in everything. Budgets are prioritizing, reprioritizing, and cutting where necessary, and we know there are excesses in certain areas. The other one I've got a concern, Honorable Chair, which impacts definitely on this arrangement, is when you have a UN deployment, currently it stands at a 75% refund or reimbursement rate, at 75%. Which means South Africa spends 100%, they only get 75% back. That's according to our annual report. The AU one, I can't even reflect on it. There is no record that I know exactly of what the reimbursement is for the African deployments. So what South Africa actually gets back. And those funds that are going into those deployments go in because of a need that happens, and it's not really planned. And there's not even a contingent that I know in the budget that speaks to deployment. This allocation has been left to it. So I think from the department side and ministry as well, we'd like to see more certainty in its planning, because the defense review cannot be based on all these loose ends. We cannot develop a competent and capable defense force if you have all these gaps within the system, because we are defeating the entire purpose of having a sound defense. So the budget issues and how it must be balanced need to be considered. The reimbursement by the UN and African deployments need to be considered. All the institutions that contribute to education and skills development. Now, there are a number of options in that regard besides the private sector. And I think those things need to be explored, and there needs to be some research done, and we need to have a report on that, because that can definitely supplement this budget of the reserve to train people. Then, of course, there's possibly also international agreements that we have with other countries that also put money into training and development and leadership programs. The other one is that we have people that have basically become military vets. When they join, want to join the reserve force, how is it structured? Is it similar to you served in the defense in some way or the other, which was non-statutory or statutory? That was your position before. When you join the reserve, you will then occupy a similar position, which means anybody that is too old and was a regular soldier, a private, will not be able to join the reserve because he cannot perform the private's duty. Is that the correct understanding? Then, of course, in terms of international best practice, I'm sure, Honorable Chair, that General Anderson has considered, what is the ratio that we normally looked at? In the long term, we see the defense review works to about 1-to-1 eventually by the fourth milestone. But essentially, the regular force is much bigger than the reserve force. But in the long term, they're looking at a 1-to-1 almost ratio. The concern I have also here is the argument that unemployment is the factor that the department considers that they must now look at reserves, not as reserves really, but to become more regular soldiers. Therefore, we need to employ people on a permanent basis rather than on a reserve basis. That has been the argument yesterday. And what I see here is that the reserve force has been, that particular unit has been very successful in placing people at 65% success rate. Now, if that can be pursued and it can be done at 90% or 100%, it means that the reserve force would be the better option in view of our budgetary constraints. So I think those things need to be looked at seriously, and also in terms of incentives or rebates or anything that can encourage employers to be considerate and also their contribution to the country, and also not only to the country but to the continent wherever our soldiers are deployed. And I think those type of things need to be looked at, and if there can be a special club for those people that join, employers that join this particular type of forum, so that we can encourage employers to play their role as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Members. Over to you, General.
Thank you, Chairperson. With your permission, I might call on support for some of the questions where there are specialists around the table. I failed, by the way, to recognize the fact that you sent a researcher to our defense symposium. So thank you for that. It was very nice having him with us. Right, let's go through the questions, and I hope I do justice to all of them. Mr. Mania's first question was, why was the 1998 defense review not implemented? Because then we wouldn't be in this financial position. The difficulty with the weakness, and I wasn't part of it, is that it doesn't define the size of the reserve force. It uses the words a small regular force and a sufficiently large reserve force. Now, you can imagine sufficiently large can be interpreted as smaller or bigger. And that has been fought ever since 1998. So what has in fact happened is the regular force has got bigger, particularly at the middle rank groups, colonel and sergeant major. Why it didn't get implemented, I'm not in a position to say, but I can confirm it was not implemented. Second point is, no, I'm not not contradicting the defense review on the numbers, because let's just recap. For the first two milestones for the reserves, they talk about active. And I'm saying we've got 15,000 active. To get there, we've got 22,000, of which we use 15,000, and 15,000 we've got, and I am in fact supporting the defense review. To be honest, that number came from my office, so therefore I would support it, because General Gibbs works for me. And we fed that into the system, and it was tested and accepted. So I don't think we are contradicting it. And I'll come back to the later question about how many do you need to produce the milestones, you know, to get, but we've got 22,000. So will we shrink? The answer is potentially, because there's no feeder system. So the reserves will shrink. So from 22,000, it could come down. But I am confident that we can put 15,000 on the ground, which milestone one requires. The other 7,000 is a pool, but we're not using them. It's not always the same people in the 7,000, because people sometimes, their circumstances change, and therefore we call up different people. What are we doing about a feeder system?
We're trying to do two things, but the facts are we don't have the money. The first thing is HR came up with what they called a new system called a reserve development system. Because if we call up people into the MSDS system and we say at the end of the term, oh, you've got a contract in the regular force and you go into the reserve force, that's not a happy position. Because those people have had 2 years of being the breadwinner and suddenly, forgive the word, they're on the streets. So what we came up with in the plan that we put forward is a separate intake for the reserves where they know on day one they will never join the regular force. They will always be reservists. And we will build into that 2 years a skills transfer process and a link into employers such as Transnet, Prasa, etc. Now that system is there, but it's not funded. The second thing we've asked to do, particularly in the non-infantry, is to go back to direct recruitment. In other words, the battalions, I'm sorry I'm giving army examples again, so I apologize to my colleagues from other service. The battalions go to the schools, including the rural areas. They recruit people. Those people then get evaluated centrally by the services to check the standard, to make sure the psychometric tests are the same. And they get trained at nodal points. So in Cape Town, there's 40 Kapa. I'm sure you all know that's the Reserve Force base in Cape Town is 40 Kapa. So there would be a trading team at 40 Kapa who would train for the Cape Town Highlands, the Cape Town Rifles, Regiment, Vistelijke Provincie, and so on to go on. Once that training is done, an independent team comes in from, say, the School of Infantry and does an independent evaluation. Now, that process is a lot cheaper than 2 years MSDS. And that's the way to build up particularly the artillery, the air defense artillery, and the armor. That's what we want to do. Once again, that is not funded. So, we're not getting recruits from MSDS. The proposed RDS, Reserve Development System, is not funded, and direct recruitment is also not funded. And added to that, the University Reserve Training Program is having to pause to make sure we put the money that is there not into basic training, but into the functional training to make sure these young lieutenants can actually be deployable. So it's a function of money. Moving on. You asked for the analysis of the cost. The cheaper cost for the reservist lies in the fact that you're not paying the reservist when not called up. Clearly, if you call up a reservist, in the main, the cost is no different. With one small wrinkle, the reservist never gets beyond the first notch. I've been a general for 10 years. I'm still paid as if I was a first-year regular force general. I don't have a problem with that, but so it is cheap. In other words, the reservists are not getting notch increases. We're addressing that as a matter of principle, but that's not a major factor. You must also look at the other side of the equation. When you call a reserve force member up, you retrain. But even taking into account the retraining, if you take it not over 1 year deployment, you take it over 5 years, the reservist costs you less than 60% of a regular force soldier. There's a 40% at least saving. But the saving is the fact that when you're not called up, you're not paid, you don't have medical, you don't have pension. So that's the sums. But there is a retraining cost. We will not deploy a reservist without full retraining. The question was asked about special forces. Mr. Mania, I'm not in a capacity to capable of answering that. There are a few reserve force specialist force members, but how they're deployed, where they're deployed, for obvious reasons, doesn't cross my desk and shouldn't cross my desk. So I can just say there are some, but it's not a large number. But I'm sorry, I can't answer you. And then your comment on closing the squadrons. I understand what, as a businessman, I understand your problem. The net result is that the baby's out with the bathwater at the moment. And, you know, even if it was said it was abuse that the pilot would arrive with a different aircraft, it was still cheaper. And the second point is, if you say the pilot must arrive with own aircraft, the implication is that he'll be white. I'm generalizing. So the black pilots are then put at a big disadvantage because they can't often can't bring their own aircraft. So there was an unintended consequence. But that there were concerns that are being addressed. I can just assure you that the Chief of the Air Force has told me on our one-on-one that he's addressing this, and when the system is reopened, the Chief of the Air Force will have closed, will have tested the system to make sure that nothing's ever abuse-free, but the scope for abuse will be 99% eliminated. Chief of the Air Force has got this in hand. Then we move to the rank group. In other words, in the reserve forces, the senior ranks tend to be males. That is the reality, because where do those males come from? The males come from the former forces, or increasingly, the leader group is coming from former regulars. And those regulars that are exiting tend to be males. We will not get the female ratio right unless we get the money to bring new blood into the reserves. We're doing our best. We're very conscious of it. We General Malefi attends the gender work groups. We focus. We're serious about it, but we can't get there. Then the question was a very, very good question about our slide on page 16. Doesn't tell us how many females in the UTIP. Chairperson, with your permission, I'm just going to ask General Malefi, who chairs the UTIP work group, to just fill in that space that we should have answered in the slides.
Thank you, General. At this stage, yes, ma'am, we acknowledge that we are lacking in terms of getting our ratio right between female and male. But currently, we're standing, for the numbers that we have, at 27% females, and which makes 68 the total of 68 members, and then 73% for the males for the University Reserve Training Program. Yes, sir, and on that note, sir, I can also just confirm with the Honourable Member that we have been, for example, in our 2014 intake in KZN, we have been to University of Zululand and University of KZN and the Durban University of Technology. KZN in both the Durban and the Pietermaritzburg campuses.
Thank you. Then moving on, the question was asked, why are there 19 people whose race is unknown? There were 19 people who say, you've said, this is the new South Africa. I'm not white, I'm not black, I'm not Indian, I'm not colored, I'm a South African. And they refuse to put it on the form. Then the next question was, is there an imbalance in the rank group? I agree, there's an imbalance in the rank group. In other words, I'm sorry we're going to use a terrible expression, but it's been used before. There's Irish coffee, in other words, white at the top and black at the bottom from captain upwards. Sorry, it's not a nice term. From sergeant major upwards, biased towards white. Major upwards, biased towards. We can only rectify that if we can have money to train the black youngsters. We've got black youngsters who are ready for promotion. They've done the courses, but there's no money to give them the practical experience. The president says the budget must cover backlogs. That's right. You know, how can I put this? There's always waste and fat in a system. I can't say we're perfect, but what I can tell you as a businessman, and I mean this as a businessman, not as a soldier, the Defence Force is budget is penal. We are losing capabilities. That's where we are now. We are losing. I'm telling you as a businessman, not as a soldier. Yes, we could find inefficiencies, I'm sure, in any organization. But this reserve, this Defence Force is losing capabilities because the budget is just not there. Can we get to the rural areas? I'll hand over after the next question to General Comfer, who will share with you the rural development plan, which goes beyond building of bridges. The transformation in the Air Force, I can't comment on. Unfortunately, the Director Air Force Reserve is not here today. How do you get historically disadvantaged individuals into the Air Force? I think that's a question for the Air Force. In the reserves, we're trying our darndest to get them in, and we are succeeding in part. I can tell you that in the Air Force's University Reserve Training Program, they are focusing, like the Navy, on engineers, engineering students, and most of them are black. but that's a small part of the total. Chairperson, with your permission, could General Comfort just sketch briefly the rural development plan and how it affects the reserves?
Chair, thank you. What we've done is we've developed a concept and aligned it with Goal 4 in the Defence Review. If you read Goal 4, developmental and other audit tasks, and under Goal 4, Task 13, contribute to the development of South Africa and its people. And we're going to address the whole spectrum of rural development, but we're not going to deviate from our core business. Our core business is to train soldiers. So what we're going to do is to use our collateral utility to try and make a contribution to the developmental agenda. So the whole spectrum that we're going to address is, first of all, HR development. We're going to recruit the youth into the reserves and then reskill them to be utilized in that province for various tasks. For example, we're going to start a pilot in the Northwest province. And the previous Premier, Thandi Modise, indicated to me that they're, for example, sitting with a problem of water purification in the Northwest province and many other provinces. So the idea is, in terms of that particular one, in that regard, so we're going to recruit reserves into the system, train them as soldiers, and then place them back in their rural communities after they've been reskilled. So when they are not called up as reserves, they will be utilized in that regard, but they still stay part of the military family. And that's the reason why they will go back to the rural areas. Secondly, we also will be involved in infrastructure development like building of bridges, etc. And the last one, which we are also investigating, is in terms of procurement. Because what we're doing is we're spending more than 800 million a year on our military messes across South Africa. But most of those units buy centrally from provinces like Gauteng. And for example, when I investigated the whole situation in Limpopo, we're sitting with a military base in Toyandou, but that military base is buying everything from Gauteng. And the emerging farmers and small-scale farmers around Toyandou are not benefiting from the fact that there's a military unit from which they can procure. So this is the whole idea. We're going to try and address the whole spectrum of rural development without deviating from our core business by using our collateral utility across South Africa. And we're going to start with a pilot project.
Perhaps, Chairperson, I should have explained that General Comfort's got a doctorate, but he was also one of South Africa's biggest farmers before he decided to spend his time almost full-time in the reserve forces. So when he talks about rural development, he is a very experienced farmer. The question was asked very validly. How do you reconcile the fact that your budget's been cut, particularly now the 700 million that we're dealing with, and you want to recruit? The answer is with great difficulty. How do we get a new intake into the reserves? How do we develop the officers? How do we do continuation training? How do we do transformation and still provide up to 65% of the deployments with a cut budget? As a businessman, I don't have a silver bullet. It's a very real challenge. The point was made about the ratio between regulars and reserves in the force design. It said it's come to 50-50. What are the international benchmarks? I think one needs to understand that what is biasing the number of regulars is that always the core skills will be retained in the regulars. Therefore, the training institutions will be regular force heavy. But if you really want to get an understanding of what the thought is for the reserves, you need to break down the three divisions in the army and look at the ratio there between regulars and reserves. And you'll see that the reserves are between 60 and 70% of the conventional fighting force. What brings the regular number up to the 50-50 is the headquarters and the training institutions. Now, does it make sense to have that breakdown? You've seen that in the British Army they are shrinking the regulars and growing the reserves. There is doubt in the UK as to whether the reserves can meet the recruitment requirements, and the jury's out. The cynics are saying the Ministry of Defence has got it wrong. Unfortunately, in South Africa, we don't have a recruitment problem at the moment. If the reserves suddenly, if our employment rate in the country went up, will we be able to sustain this level? That's the jury's still out on. That's why we want to now make the reserve service system more employer-friendly. And that's why we've set up these defense provincial liaison councils where we're meeting with the captains of industry and saying to them, what do you need from us to allow your employees to come and do reserve service? And we're getting invaluable feedback. Because there's no doubt that we are helping industry by training their staff, giving them leadership training, management training, confidence in themselves. A man or woman who comes back from 12 months in the Sudan is not the same person who left. They grow tremendously and quickly. And the employers are recognizing that. But I think the regulatory reserves in the divisions, and forgive me for leaving out the three other services, I'm sure I'm going to get a reaction from my colleagues when we leave this room, but the majority of the reserves tend to be in the Army, is that in the three divisions, that is the Special Operations Divisions, the Motorized Division, and the Mechanized Division, it's 60 to 70% reservists. The question was asked, what are we doing to get the MK and UPLA skills in? We went, in the early years, 10, 15 years ago, we tried very hard. And we succeeded in part and we failed in part. Now, of course, the reality is that age is catching up on all of us. And there are fewer and fewer former non-statutory force people that are meeting the age profile. By the way, I'm on my second year of extension. The chief didn't want me to go, but I need to retire. I'm also getting to that age. So, unfortunately, the time has passed many of the veterans from whatever source, MK, UPLA, SADF. So, there I think our role should be to embrace the veteran system and to get them involved in the veteran system and to give them opportunities in the veteran system. But, you know, you don't need a 60-year-old rifleman. Then the question came up again as the 15,000 versus the 22,000. I think the questioner summarized it very nicely. We've got 15,000 out of the 22,000. The defense review says we must have 15,000. If there's no intake, that 22,000, there will be natural attrition. But I'm confident that we will be able to, for the foreseeable future, put 15,000 reserves on the ground if required. And that's what we're doing. But it does mean that if we want to put 25,000 on the ground for Milestone 2, we'll probably need to have 30,000 in the system to guarantee 25,000. The National Youth Service does not fall under the reserves. It falls under human resources. The points being made about getting funding from the Department of Education from the CETA is absolutely valid. It's not for me to speak on behalf of the Chief of Human Resources, but I know he talks to us about it. He's working on that. It's not within my domain, but it is being addressed. The question was raised, how can you balance matters when you've got 720 million budget cut coming? Well, you know, it's at the stage where the Chief of the Defence Force has to say, do it. And somehow, we got to do it. We don't turn down the instructions that we get from the Commander-in-Chief or from Parliament. We do it. But it's getting tougher and tougher. The point is well made about the 75% UN reimbursement. Is there 25% leakage? Why aren't we getting 100%? I know Chief of Joint Operations is beating the drum on this. Chief of Logistics is beating the drum on this. We've got to make sure that our vehicles are serviceable, that we get a full refund, that we only put the right number of troops there, not one more, one less than the UN wants. I can only say from where I sit, and it's not a reserve issue, it's high on the list. I think I dealt with the veterans issue. I've indicated that in the infantry brigades in the three divisions, the ratio of reserves to regulars is 60-40 or 70-30. And then the point is well made, do we not need to incentivize the employers? The answer is, in due course, we'd have to, otherwise the system won't work. But right now, sadly, the majority of reserve force members do not have civilian employment. The leader group do, the officers and NCOs do, and we're working closely with the employers. That's why we formed these defense provincial liaison councils, who are meeting with big employers. As an aside, there's some great examples the best example is the post office, which provides their employees with full pay during the reserve force system. Of course, the reserve force itself is having its own challenges. But in closing, perhaps people don't realize that the postal service into our deployment, starting from Burundi to today, has been maintained non-stop by reserve forces. The 11th Field Post Office that does all the postal services in the Defence Force is a reserve force unit. Another employer that has now come to the table with regard to incentivizing their employees to do reserve service is Transnet. And that's because CEO Brian Malefi is a reserve force colonel himself. Chairperson, I hope I've done justice to it. But no doubt there could be a follow-up if you feel I've skipped.
Thank you once more, General. Do we have any follow-up questions, honorable members? No follow-up questions. Thank you very much. We must agree, honorable members, that the reserve force is a very important component of our defense force. We may need to have an interaction with this component, SECDEF, a regular interaction, because we haven't done very well in the last parliament in terms of interacting with the reserve force. So we have, honorable members have been missing out on this important component. Now, what I suggest, honorable members, is that we need to have a quarterly interaction with them. As you come, SECDEF, I think the component of the reserve force should be set aside and ring-fenced, because there are matters that were raised here by General Anderson which will need a follow-up. So we need to do that follow-up because we as a committee, we also need to support the reserve force. And I will also urge members that in their constituencies, they should also popularize the programs that you have, programs and projects of the reserve force, so that our communities should know those programs and participate in those programs. That is basically how we'll end it up. And then, honorable members, we are done with this item. Can we go straight to reading our report? And I'm going to need a mover and a seconder for the adoption of the report. The report reads as follows. The Portfolio Committee on Defense and Military Veterans, having considered the request for approval by Parliament of the United Nations Arms Trade Treaty referred to it, recommends that the House, in terms of Section 231, Subsection 2 of the Constitution, approves said treaty. Request to be considered. Can we have a mover for the adoption and a seconder, honorable members? Honorable Nisi, thank you very much. Honorable Kamede, thank you very much. Honorable Menia.
Chair, I wonder if you would record for the minutes. In terms of our processes, the final decision about whether we support or oppose the treaty will be taken by our caucus, but I intend to strongly recommend that our caucus supports the treaty on Thursday morning.
Thank you very much, Honorable Menia. The report is adopted. Thank you very much. We have come to the end of our meeting. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Share and come with JJ.